and Human Service Budget Reform to order. Today is Thursday, March 17th, and we will declare this a subcommittee of the committee since we don't have a quorum at this juncture, but for purposes of continuing our informational meetings, I actually think this works just fine.
We can make Rick vote.
We don't want to put that kind of pressure on him. Before we get into our topic for the day, are there any announcements from staff?
Yes, Chair. On the table in front of you is the executive summary of a report titled A Study of Alternative Rate Setting Approaches for Oregon Health Plan Fully Capitated Plans. This is part of a report that we'll be hearing about on April the 7th, a week from Monday. Several people from Mercer are coming in to overview the report. This is a product that came out of House Bill 2519 last year that called for a study on alternative approaches to funding plans. And so the Mercer people will be coming in April 7th. We're going to get a panel together of fully capitated health plan people, extend the meeting from 5 to 6 p.m., and have them do the report, have the health plan people kind of act as a responding panel to that. So if you want the full report, I will email it to you electronically.
Is this a report that says MedVIPA and Family Care pay for everything? And, you know, all the rest, is that what this report is?
Chair, that might be in the body of the report. I did not see it in the executive summary.
I think that was on the floating fees.
Yeah, on the floating fees. Okay. Just for the record, so someone 20 years from now knows, that was a Central Oregon's version of humor, since nobody laughed.
They're scared you had a minute. This time.
Get the defibrillator for Hetherington. Let's get right into our program, and we do have a quorum, so that is a good thing. We will continue with our informational meeting and call two. Are you all coming up together? Is that the plan? Call Jan Buffa, Chad Nagel, and Dr. Rohr to the podium. Talk about Marion Polk County Health Plans Administrative Service Organization Model, the fabled S. I thought those were ASOs. Oh, Administrative Service Organization Model. Yeah, ASO. Hey, it's Thursday, really Friday. We're all going home, and we appreciate you being here. Please enter and sign in, please.
My name is...
You got to get real friendly with those things, Jan.
Thank you, Chairman Westland. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. My name is Jan Buffa. I am the Chief Executive Officer of Mid-Valley IPA, local provider group, headquartered in Salem, Oregon. I'm also the CEO of Marion Polk Community Health Plan, the company that is currently providing Oregon Health Plan services in Marion and Polk County service area.
Great. Chad?
Also, I'd like to thank you, Chairman Westland. My name's Chad Nagel. I'm the CFO of the Marion Polk Community Health Plan and a senior financial analyst at the Mid-Valley IPA.
Where did you go to college?
University of Oregon.
Yes. Thank you.
I don't start that petty stuff.
You ask the question, you get the answer.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Michael Rohr. I am the CEO of PH Tech, which is the company which provides claims processing, some data support and member services for Marion Polk Community Health Plan. I also have served as the medical director for Mid-Valley IPA for the period of 1997 to 2000 and practiced medicine in Salem since 1981.
Now that we have that formality out of the way, as well as the relevant question, do whatever you're going to do.
Thank you, sir.
We appreciate you being here.
Thank you very much. At this time, I'd like to direct you to this PowerPoint presentation. I'm going to be going over this relatively quickly. Certainly, I'm happy to entertain questions should you have them at any point in time. Chad will also interject on one of the financials we have, and then Dr. Warr will be going over the ASL model, and that's all incorporated into this handout. We had also introduced ourselves and our respective companies, and I would just direct you to these other handouts for more information at your leisure. Anyway, I'd like to give just a brief overview of Marion Polk Community Health Plan and Mid-Valley IPA, just to give us some reference. Mid-Valley IPA is located in Salem, Oregon. It was incorporated in 1991 as a mutual benefit corporation, not-for-profit, taxable. Membership includes all MDs and DOs in Marion and Polk counties. Currently, that's approximately 500 physicians. Approximately 98-99% of all practicing physicians in Marion and Polk County. To my knowledge, the only physicians that don't belong to Mid-Valley IPA are the salaried psychiatric physicians currently practicing at Salem Hospital. We, as a contracting agent and medical management company, hold contracts for commercial, Medicare, and PPO lives with 12 different health plans. And serve their populations in Marion and Polk County. That constitutes approximately, at this time, 90,000 insured lives. We have an affiliated company called Marion and Polk Community Health Plan. And again, as I've stated previously, that is an LLC that houses our Oregon Health Plan contract with the state of Oregon. Slide 3, page 2. I think it's important just to reference back to the mission statement of Mid-Valley IPA. It gives you some reference as to why the physicians in Marion and Polk County chose to participate in Oregon Health Plan as a contractor. The mission is to preserve and promote the wise use of healthcare resources in Marion and Polk counties, to enhance the ability of physicians to act as patient advocates, and to assure a sound and ethical business environment that promotes flexibility and the pursuit of appropriate opportunities. And certainly when the governor asked us if we would consider taking over Oregon Health Plan, at the point the major insurers were pulling out, the physicians, although concerned about the sheer amount of financial risk they were assuming, felt that certainly the request met with their mission and chose to go ahead and do so. In terms of what Mid-Valley IPA provides, and certainly these services allowed us to entertain the idea of becoming an Oregon Health Plan contractor, we historically as an IPA had provided managed care contracting, physician recruitment. We have a resident rotation program with Legacy and Regents out of Portland in order to recruit physicians to our service area, although that's getting more difficult at this time because of the malpractice issue. We serve as an education and information conduit to the members and physicians in our service area. We also have been successful in capitalizing and installing and maintaining a wide area network. We were very fortunate to have received some assistance financially in capitalizing that project from the commercial insurers, Regents, primarily. And we certainly feel that the wide area network allows us to run our Oregon Health Plan in the cost-effective manner. And so it's a very integral component of our architecture and in our infrastructure. We certainly have a lot of information service expertise. We have network support. We have medical management software. I think Dr. Wuhr has addressed that with some of you individually, and he can talk more about the medical management software we use. We provide training and also help desk support to that wide area network. We also perform a number of administrative insurance functions. As a company, we have claims processing, eligibility, benefit plan maintenance, provider contracting, and mailroom functions. We also do a bit of group purchasing to the degree that it benefits the members, health insurance, malpractice insurance, the practice management software, and legal consulting services. In terms of MVIPA's medical management services, and certainly this is another integral component of what Mid-Valley IPA does and provides to Marion Polk Community Health Plan. Marion Polk Community Health Plan contracts back with Mid Valley IPA for their medical management services. Our medical management department does utilization management, inpatient concurrent review, quality assurance, quality improvement, exceptional needs care coordination, complex care coordination, and development of local disease management initiatives. We have a number of initiatives ongoing at this time. We have a high-risk prenatal program. We have an asthma program. We have a CHF program and a smoking cessation program, a number of which we had running prior to becoming an Oregon Health Plan contractor. Marion Polk Community Health Plan was assumed by Mid Valley IPA under the LLC Marion Polk Community Health Plan in May of 2001 at the request of the governor. He came to the IPA board, asked the physicians if they would consider taking on this book of business and responsibility. They did so very quickly. We were able, with the assistance of OMAP, to have that up and running within 45 days of the governor's request. We worked very collegially with Regents as they exited the market. We picked up that book of business from Regents. We also picked up the book of business that ODS left when they departed, and I understand that we will be picking up a portion of the business when Kaiser departs July 1. The goal basically was... we did not have equity partners in terms of hospital equity partners. The hospitals felt the business was too risky. We, again, chose to go ahead and do it, but we do have two of the three hospitals in our service area on contract. Don't want to be redundant. It is Marion Polk Community Health Plan is an LLC owned and operated by Mid Valley IPA, so Mid Valley IPA is the sole member of the LLC. The goals of Marion Polk Community Health Plan were to enhance the access to physician care in Marion and Polk County. We were extremely concerned that if the physician group did not act as a contractor for this population and Regents and ODS left the market, that these individuals would not have access to primary care. And the physicians felt it was very, very important to maintain their assimilation into the commercial population. They did not want these individuals to be disenfranchised once again back out into kind of a disparate population, having to seek their care at urgent care and in emergency room services. We wanted to reduce some administrative overhead. We had consistently done well with Regents and ODS financially as just a provider panel, but we were being charged 10 to 12% admin costs when we were functioning as a provider panel. And we felt because of our local nature, our size, our inability to act a bit quicker because of our smaller size, that we could perform all these required administrative services at a reduced cost.
And Jan, let me interrupt you there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a, I think, key component of the thinking of, and I'm pretty sure I speak for every member of this committee, present or otherwise, that we are very impressed with the fully capped plan's ability to manage.
Yep.
And I know there's a risk-reward component in there. That's all fine. My question is, and this isn't a bash Regents
sure.
session, but I mean, really, I mean, how can you guys cut that much administration off what I assume is an otherwise professionally, prudently run, you know, private for-profit company? I think that's astounding. Can you flesh that out, or...
I appreciate that. That's a compliment, certainly. Number one, we have 22 staff people.
And it just blows me away.
In my opinion, the response to that would be we're locally owned and driven. Our members are taking care of the patients on the front lines. We have a small shop. We are very electronically driven. We're able to make decisions quickly because of inherent in our size and because we do work for the physicians that are treating and caring for this population. And all of that equates to incredible flexibility and autonomy in management and decision making. And coupled with the fact that we were able to put in this wide area network and have Dr. Rohr's expertise in terms of developing the medical management software we use, so we didn't have to go out and try to buy software at a market price that wasn't a solution. We have a software that was developed around our needs. It's efficient. We have the management and in-house capabilities to deal with these folks in an incredibly flexible manner and individualize the product, you know, within the state's guidelines. And I think any time you get an institution the size of Regents, you know, they're going to be restricted by their sheer size and the formality of the organization and all of their internal culture and restraints. Again, we did well with Regents in Marion and Polk County. You know, Marion and Polk County was not where Regents lost their money. We historically, you know, even though we were charged a 10% admin, the relationship was good. At the end of the year, the finances, the bottom line looked good. But they're an extremely large company with their own culture. And that would be my response.
Representative Bates.
Well, I just want to make a comment here, too. Jen, I think you're being pretty modest about this, to tell you the truth. And I suppose that's being politically correct. I remember about 2 years ago going to a meeting of about 150, 200 physicians, and there were not a lot of smiling faces in that audience about what you guys were embarking on. You were picking up about 40 or 45,000 lives. You were going to do it a month and a half. The risks were huge. There was concerns that you'd bring down the entire organization trying to do this, but you led the charge saying, we can do this, we can control costs, we can make this work. And I want to compliment you on doing that. I've always wondered what happened after I left that, that meeting that day. Probably don't want to know. But those physicians out of a social contract, a social conscience, stepped up and did this thing, and you led the charge in that and made it work. My guess is that there's more here than you've told us. You've got some cost controls built into the system that some insurers don't have. You know the population, and that makes a difference because they're used to working with a different type of population. And I believe you probably have cost controls in place that they haven't done. And you've taken away two things. One of the two things you've taken away is the adversarial position between physicians and insurance companies. And it's always been, we'll get as much out of you as we can, and we'll give you as little as we can, and there was never any effort between them to control costs. And the insurers have an attitude, to a certain degree, that they do want to control costs, but in the end, if they can't control costs, they just raise the premium. And you can't raise the premium, so you have to make it work. And I think that's two of the drivers that are different here. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with you, sir.
So I'm going back to what the chair asked you. How did you do it? How'd you do it?
Well, I understood your answer. I didn't understand hers.
I apologize.
No. You, I think you were being very deferential, which is a prudent thing to be when you're sitting at that microphone.
Well, I appreciate the compliments, Representative Bates, and it certainly was a huge fiscal endeavor. We were very confident about our abilities to manage this population because we did manage it under Regents. Regents had medically delegated to us for years, both this population and their commercial population. So we were not going to be doing a whole lot different. What we had the flexibility to do when they got out and we stepped in, though, we were able to go out and do the contracting with the ancillary providers ourselves. It was our experience that we got more cost-effective contracts with the ancillary providers, so we were able to reduce our ancillary provider costs.
Fine ancillary.
Yes. We were able to reduce our ancillary service costs through renegotiating the contracts that Regents had. We weren't legally allowed to go out and contract with those ancillary providers when we were only a provider.
Give us a definition or an example of an ancillary provider.
An ancillary provider would be a DME company, PBM, pharmacy benefit management company,
hospitals,
nursing homes, hospitals,
okay.
All the way down the line. Everybody that's not a physician.
Okay.
In addition, again, the software has made a huge difference. It allows us to keep minimal staff on hand to get the job done. And I can't overstate how important that is, the medical management software. If I had to have 50, 60, 70, 100 staff people, I could not run this health plan below budget. I would be over budget. I am able to run the entire plan under budget, and that means medical budget and administrative budget, because I keep my staffing very tight but appropriate, and I can only do that because of the wide area network, which is the electronics, and the medical management software. If I was having to do everything in a very paper-intensive, labor-intensive manner, and I know some of the plans do have significantly more staff than we do, and it has to do with electronics and medical management software, it gets precipitously more expensive.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Merkley.
Could you just give us a description of this wide area network? How does it differ from communicating via email? What is it that you're doing? Is it every doctor is tied in and does all their prescribing and all their medical documents over this network, or what's really going on that?
Yes, sir, and I certainly would ask Dr. Rohr or Chad to jump in because I'm not the technophile at the office. Basically, we put in a large group of servers in an office adjacent to Mid-Valley IPA. We then, and this was 7 or 8 years ago, we put in T1 lines all over Marion and Polk County. We also had hardware at that time. You had to purchase routers. We put those in 180 different physician office sites. We then literally bought PCs for offices that didn't have PCs, so they'd quit using their fax machines and quit phoning because that reduced our labor in-house. As the technology has improved, we have been able to go to some fiber optics, get away from the hardware, the routers, so it's gotten less expensive over time. Our initial monthly maintenance costs of that wide area network were $50,000 a year just to maintain the monthly T1 lines, the phone bills, etc. Because we pay for all that, we don't charge the offices for any of that. They also have email capability. We do a lot of our medical management through email. The medical management software goes over those lines. So the staff in the physician's office and the physician, if they choose to, can interface with our medical directors and our RN staff through that screen. And it's Windows-based. It's not DOS-based. But over time, the hardware of the wide area network has become more sophisticated, so our monthly maintenance costs have gone from $60,000 down to about $25,000 or $30,000. So it's still an incredible cost for the physicians to bear as a company. They're not bearing it individually in their offices. It's not being financed by them individually in their offices. We finance those things through operational savings internally. But it is because of that wide area network. And at any time, any one of you are more than welcome to come to the office, and we would be more than happy to demonstrate that to you in terms of just utilizing that PC and the software, et cetera. The servers are less interesting.
Representative, one thing that's important to note is that the wide area network is available to every physician in the community. A new physician comes on, there's not a lot of upfront costs that they need to expense to themselves for getting on this. They pay $300 IPA fee, and we'll get them set up on the wide area network with all the capabilities.
Are there any further incentives? Okay, I mean, you charge them $300, nothing. Go ahead.
Yes, Chairman Wesley.
I mean, other than just, hey, this works, it's going to save us all money, we're all in this together type thinking.
The incentive is that to be a member of Mid-Valley IPA, they pay a $300 a year membership fee, like Chad's spoken about. We're not for profit, so we didn't sell shares. if they want to be a member, which they don't have to be a member to practice medicine in Marion and Polk County, but if they choose to be a member of Mid Valley IPA, they pay their $300, they go through a credentialing process, they're credentialed, they're accepted, they have to participate in our Oregon Health Plan product if they want to participate in the other commercial contracts. And in my mind, that is the financial incentive. That's probably a large incentive. I'd like to believe they also participate because it's the right thing to do. But I will tell you, it's probably because in order to be a member, they have to participate. Now, they do so on a continuum. Like any good project, 20% of them take care of 80% of this population. So I don't, you know, certainly those 20% deserve far more credit in serving these folks, but they all do participate, and it's required.
Mr. McColgan.
Thank you, Chair. When you say they participate, is there a minimum kind of a quota required of doctors to, you know, one or five clients a month? Or
There is. It's very difficult to monitor that. Initially, they were required to have 200 clients or 20% of their practice. That was a very difficult number to quantify because certainly they take care of a lot of indigent outside of Marion Polk Community Health Plan, and we do not, as an IPA, have access to those numbers. So what we chose to do, because we could not quantify that, and fortunately we've not had a material access problem, we discussed the situation as a board, the difficulty in quantifying what they're doing outside Mid Valley, outside Marion and Polk County in terms of contribution to the community. So we chose to change our reimbursement to the individuals who do take care of this population. And we have a three-tiered payment system whereby the conversion factor is the same for everybody who cares for these individuals, but based on the percentage of Marion and Polk Community Health Plan, Oregon Health Plan clients in your practice, depending on which benchmark you hit, and the group in this 20%, they receive a $6 PMPM case management fee. And for example, one clinic here who has over 80% OHP clients in their practice, they receive a $25,000 to $35,000 a month capitation case management fee in addition to the conversion factor they receive when they build services. So that is a huge incentive for those, that 20%, to continue to maintain that type of practice culture. Obviously, this is a group of practitioners who choose to have this type of practice. For those individuals whose practice patient mix is predominantly commercial, they all do take a percentage of OHP, certainly not always up to 20%, but they certainly value the fact that these other 20% of their peers take care of these individuals, and they were willing to reallocate those monies. And so that is how the board resolved the issue over the staff's inability to quantify and to monitor who's got 20% and who doesn't.
Please continue.
Just real quickly, just in terms of that slide four to finish reasons, excuse me, it's actually slide six. We wanted to provide as much money as possible to direct patient care, and we felt that by being able to reduce our administrative costs, we could use those additional monies to put towards direct patient care, and we do that. And we can go into that if you'd like to. There's definitely certain areas that we don't feel our cap payment covers the cost of care, and so we subsidize those out of the administrative monies that we get that we don't spend. And we also wanted to have enough money, had to have enough money, it wasn't just a desire on our part, to meet our contractual solvency and net worth requirements in order to continue to participate as a health plan. If you turn to demographics, slide 7, and then specifically slide 8, just to give the committee kind of a summary, There are approximately 49,000 Medicaid folks in Marion and Polk counties. What Marion and Polk County has, or MIPCHIP has, in terms of a percentage of that is significantly less, but there are approximately 49,000 in Marion and Polk County now requiring or meeting OHP eligibility guidelines. If you look at slide 9, it delineates for you what MIPCHIP has, or Marion and Polk Community Health Plan has, in terms of enrollment. And certainly since we've gotten back into standard, our enrollment stands at about 29,000. Kaiser's still in with around 2,000 to 2,500 clients. Care Oregon is also serves this area with approximately 5,000 clients. And there are approximately 12,800 clients that remain on open card. During the course of the 2 years we've been in business, OMAP has rolled a number of those open card folks onto our plan. I don't know that they're doing so at this time, but we certainly have been open and continue to remain open for open card enrollment. It's our preference that these folks do come onto our plan in order that we can better manage them. In terms of health plan demographics, because of the standard issue, I thought you all might be interested in the fact that of our health plans, patient mix, approximately 19% of our 29,000 clients were standard or non-standard.
Excuse me, I'm representing
the base. I just had a question about the open card patient for a moment. We pretty well are convinced that open card patients, if there's a plan available, should be inside the plan.
Yes, sir.
What's preventing you from bringing these people in? I know there's some federal requirements, they have a choice, but if that choice were to go away, would you accept these people? And what's blocking you right now?
We have accepted those people in the past. We are open at this time. In my mind, to my recollection, there's nothing that's blocking us at this time. Certainly access is an issue. We're constantly titrating. You know, do we have access? Do we not? Again, I mentioned the 20% of the individuals that take care of 80% of this population. It is difficult to recruit to Marion and Polk County, maybe to Oregon at this time. I can only speak to Marion and Polk County. All of the practitioners here, there is no excess capacity. They've extended hours in their practices, and it really is titrating access. So to the degree that we can take them on and provide access, we want to do that. Did you have a
question? Representative, I think to just make sure that your question is correct or that I'm understanding your question is, would we have the ability to take on these members, or why don't we take on these members?
Both.
I guess I could answer part of that in that we will take on members that are assigned to us, which are a lot of the 12,000 if they choose us or the case managers assign them to us. The second is that not all open card members are eligible for the health plans. There are some that, for example, a pregnant mother that comes on to OHP in the third trimester is not eligible onto one of the managed care plans. The end-stage renal disease patients are not eligible to come on a managed care plan. Some of the transplant patients aren't, and various scenarios like that. But a lot of it has to do with assignment, I think.
Staff reminds me that when you're addressing Dr. Bates, to speak in less than 3-syllable words, please. What is titrating?
I apologize.
That's quite all right.
It's my own vernacular. It is in the dictionary, however.
But I know. And what is
if you bring them in too fast and you haven't got
so you just ease them in.
It ease them in.
I knew that. Bottom line to a very serious line of questioning. You feel you will be able to titrate this population?
We have remained open, sir. Since we initiated the plan, we have remained open to open enrollment.
With the exception of the ones that are not.
Right. Right.
Third month of pregnancy and something I don't ever hope to understand what it is, but I believe you that's an exception.
You don't want.
Yeah, I don't need to know that. But then, okay, and so that you've obviously already answered this question.
which seems to be a key to your management success, is you already know this population.
Yes, sir. We had 7-8 years of claims data on these individuals, and we'd already been medically managing them. What we weren't able to do was we weren't able to do a lot of the ancillary contracting ourselves.
Right.
And ultimately, even though we medically managed them, it was always the plan's prerogative to override our appeals. And anecdotally, but even more than anecdotally, the plans tended to pay for things that were below the line. And in order to maintain budget neutrality or to just break even, we have to manage tighter to the line. We do not have the financial wherewithal to pay anybody anything and pay for everything.
So I think that begs the question, I mean, bigger picture, and I'm not trying to put you on the spot here,
sure.
But I mean, how well do the other plans know this population? Unanswerable? I mean, unfair question?
No, sir. It's a fair question. Based on my experience with the other contractors, because they have been in business managing this population since almost OHP inception, they know their populations extremely well.
So even family care?
Yes, sir.
You can't mean family care.
Yes, I do.
Oh, okay. I'm just checking.
I want to get...
You don't believe they... Yeah, family care either. I can see that. I see that look on your face.
I can't believe anything they say, you know. I want to get back to this open card situation again.
Sure.
Okay, our goal is to get the open card people into managed care to hold down costs so we can expand the population. I mean, that's what we're trying to do here. We have a limited amount of revenue, and we want to make that go as far as we can. So the real question I'm trying to get to is, you get 12,000 people out there, they're not all in the third trimester on renal dialysis. Well, I'm not sure why they shouldn't be in the plan anyway. We shouldn't be under your tent anyway. But are the case managers preventing you from getting them in there? Is it patient choice won't come in? What prevents you from having already accepted 10,000 of that 12,000 into your plan?
Representative, the health plan's actually... It's illegal for us to go out and market our health plan in the community. And it solely has to do with case managers as well as, you know, whether it's member assignment or whether the members choose the health plan.
I would add to that, Representative Bates, that we have been open, and initially they were enrolling 200 to 300 a week to our plan. I cannot tell you what's being enrolled to our plan on a weekly basis at this time, but historically it was 200 to 300 a week. This number is significantly less than it was originally. We assumed the ODS population. We assumed the Regents population. We literally ramped all those people on. On the ODS population, I do believe legally they ran into some issues and there had to be a choice. They had to be given a choice, but we did end up with the majority of the ODS clients. Care Oregon is open, closed, so not everybody would come to us depending on whether they were open or closed. But again, we're open. I cannot tell you what percent of that population could not come on our plan, but It certainly is a question I would ask OMAP, but it certainly reduced from what it would be or could have been. Yes, sir.
Representative Martin.
Could you give me a ballpark? There's about 13,000 there, would you say? It be under 3,000 that would not be eligible to go on either, say, Care Oregon or yourselves?
I honestly have no idea what percent of that population is in those ineligible categories. I just do not know. I don't have that information. Certainly, if I'll be happy to research it, and I could email it to Mr. Bacovian.
Maybe a different follow-up. They are then currently going to one of your doctors.
Possibly, or they could all be presenting at the emergency room or urgent care or the health department.
Okay, or yeah, hospitals directed.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative, the one thing to note is that those 13,000 members, they do not necessarily have a PCP. They're just in our community.
Mm-hmm.
So all of our members, the 29,000 that are on our health plan, those do have PCPs assigned to them.
Okay. Thank you.
So, but I know you said you didn't know. I mean, okay, 13 and 3,000, 25%. And not to put him on the spot because he was on camera when he did this, but Jeff in the back, you know, behind you is kind of going, yeah, you know, that's about right. Okay, round numbers. That's 25% of this open card population that wouldn't be eligible?
Yes, sir.
So now he's going no, and you're going yes. 25% of the open card that wouldn't be eligible to go into managed care.
That fall into the category of either third trimester or pregnant, end-stage renal disease, the ones who categorically remain in. What percentage of that is of the open cards you think out there?
Give us a quick ID.
For the record, Jeff Hetherington with Family Care. The number that generally isn't qualified, there's several categories. I gave you two. The other is people with third-party resources. Now, OMAP can give you the number of what that is, but it's probably less than 2%. The majority of the people that are unenrolled, it's in the way we have up there, either people who are in transition, there's a small portion of that, and the rest of them is that they just haven't been enrolled.
They're not even fee-for-service?
They're in fee-for-service, but they're not enrolled in the health plan because they've just kept them in fee-for-service, and there hasn't been aggressive enrollment of those people into the plans because, like in Marion Polk County, you have mandatory enrollment. And when you have 25% unenrolled, that's because administratively they haven't put them in, which they could do. Now there is a rolling group, and there's a small group that will never go in. And I would guess, but don't hold me to this number, there's probably not more than 4% of the total population.
So if we've got 10,000 open card out there in any given district, and I was just trying to extrapolate this statewide, and we're not holding you to it yet. I mean, we're looking at someplace between 200 and 400 that either wouldn't be eligible or just wouldn't get in.
And then maybe some transition numbers. You might get up to if you had 50,000 people in the county, you might get up to, say, 3,000 that could not be enrolled for one reason.
Out of that 10,000?
Out of 50,000.
Out of 50.
Out of the 10,000, you'd still be looking at 2 to 3 that couldn't be enrolled for one reason or another. Now, OMAP can further define that, and their numbers might be better than mine.
But as a ballpark, that's not bad.
Right.
So,
I know where you're going with that question. Yeah, for us to cost this thing, we got to, and, you know, for risk you're assuming and all that stuff, it's got to all work. So I thought that was a good question. I didn't mean to make it so confusing.
I would just say, Representative Westland, that we are open. We are open to open enrollment to the degree that OMAP can catch up with their enrollment process. I do know that they are significantly behind on just putting applications through. They report to us on a monthly basis that they have staffing issues and that they are behind. They're significantly out on getting folks enrolled. So to the degree that they get folks enrolled and get them through the process, as long as our plan remains open, they can assign those folks to our plan.
Super. Keep it going.
Just real quickly, slide 10, we have approximately in our population about 19,000 standard or non-categorical. I just kind of as a caveat, when the drugs were pulled from this population because of some very painful financial analysis on our part, as much as we didn't want to, we did not feel we could continue to maintain services for these individuals because we do not have the financial wherewithal to carry those kind of deficits. We ran a number of different scenarios and again, just simply could not take that financial risk as a company. So we had opted out. But when drugs were put back in, we very much appreciate that. We immediately got back in, and we are going to take care of that standard population until there isn't a standard population. I might add with another caveat, and We are extremely concerned about the methadone issue, and that methadone was not put back in when drugs were put back into standard non-categorical, as you all are aware. So the hospital, the health department, through Jeff Davis, their administrator, and Marion Polk Community Health Plan, the cost of methadone in Marion Polk County for the clients that we had active in the program was about $250,000. And the three entities are going to pay out of our pockets for this methadone program to continue in Marion and Polk County, because we feel that it's going to cost us exponentially more not to do that. Just within the short period of time that these individuals did not get their methadone, we had two individuals end up in the hospital. Their status was not good. Their outlook was not good. And so we are going to be financing that ourselves.
And that's $250,000 a year?
Yes, sir.
And that's round numbers, how many patients?
112, sir.
Now, that's a precise answer. And welcome back. You've been here quite a few days. Thanks for being here. Okay.
Just quickly, slide 11, and we've touched base on this a bit. Our administrative costs are approximately 20-30% lower, or to phrase it another way, the commercial health plan's costs were approximately 20-30% higher than ours. Their claims expense exceeded funding in a lot of their service areas, and two of the commercial health plans, as documented in the papers and elsewhere, lost around $6 million in our service area alone. And over 40 of the patients on one of these health plans was not assigned to a primary care doctor. And when they don't have a primary care doctor, certainly they present more often in more costly, inappropriate settings like the urgent care and the emergency room.
Dr. Bates' office.
Yes.
I think it's called appropriate and inappropriate.
How long were the two commercial plans here?
Approximately 8 years.
So they're losing a little, about $750 a year or so. Mm-hmm. Okay.
If the committee doesn't have any more questions on this portion of the presentation, I'm going to go ahead and turn this over to Chad, and he's going to talk about the slide number 13, which is the estimated financial savings slide.
I just wanted to clarify, just the out-of-pocket methadone drug cost by themselves is about $2,250 per person per year.
Yes, sir. And we chose, and I should actually ask Jeff Davis, administrator for the health department. He's much more educated about this since he runs the program than I, so I don't want to misstate. We do not feel it's appropriate for us to act, quote, as we refer to it as a, quote, juice bar. We feel that they need continued services. So in addition to the methadone, we want them to be managed and have access to the full array of services. So that cost certainly would include more than just presenting at a pharmacy and getting their methadone. We think it's important that we continue the whole program, and so that's what we're financing. But we feel it's a very cost-effective program in terms of the outcomes.
Sure. And yeah, it's about $2,300 a year.
Yeah,
per patient.
$2,250. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean that doesn't shock me. That doesn't surprise me. And that.
Cheap.
I mean, that's cheap. That's cheap.
I don't know. I haven't bought drugs, so.
Mr.
Rukovian. Thank you. I just might point out that I've heard some people compare that same figure to one booking at the sheriff in jail is probably close to or in excess of that amount. So if those same clients maybe end up in a judicial system where that's absorbing a lot more cost.
Or one emergency room visit.
Well, certainly the two clients we had in the hospital within 10 days, the bills were over $30,000. So it doesn't take, you know, 2-3 weeks in the hospital, and the bill's $80,000 anyway. So we felt it was a very astute business decision.
Mr. Chair, in the hospital for overdoses?
I don't have the specific reason, but it certainly was related to their being taken off or having their methadone removed and making poor choices and just the physical ramifications of coming off of methadone and
Thank you.
I mean, there's a lot of things that could go on there. Representative Bates.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we had the same problem in Jackson County. Last week when I was on call, we had a gentleman, a man come in who had gone off methadone, got out of the program, immediately was shooting up, got a massive infection in his leg up into his groin, and was hospitalized. We'll be there probably for 3 weeks, 4 weeks, and it'll cost us $40,000, $50,000. Even if it's not, you know, OHP will pay for some of that, but the rest will be cost shifted. It's the same old story we see over and over again, so, you know what I'm talking about.
I appreciate the question. The health department did a survey of these clients prior to their medications being removed, and I'm sure Mr. Davis would be happy to share that with you. The client names are protected. It was very, very startling, shocking, sad. They were very honest about what their reaction was going to be to losing their drugs. And it pretty much devastates them and their families and, you know, has lots of family repercussions and community repercussions, as you know. But I thought it was very timely of the health department to do the survey, and I think it's unfortunate it probably didn't get all the attention that it deserved. Thank you.
Chad?
Mr. Chairman, we were
you're
asked
on 13, right?
Well, yeah, that's the analysis that I did do. I want to go back to page 12, or slide 12, okay, rather, and look at some assumptions here on that analysis. We were initially posed with the question as to what type of savings we'd be able to come up with through an ASO model and us managing some of these services. Some of the assumptions, first of all, MIPCHIP, Marion Fold Community Health Plan, and the open card population here that we're comparing, I have the assumption that it's the same. It's not the same. Just like we went through previously, the open card has members on it that are the third trimester pregnant women, the end-stage renal disease, the transplants. They are, I'm safe to say, that they're acutely ill patients, especially when compared to the regular standard and plus patients of the health plans. That being said, this analysis assumes that the open card population will be managed in the same manner that the MIPCHIP population is. Within that, our estimated savings are based on modifications of the requests for services, and that the managed services are strictly to the line. Like we spoke to before, Jan spoke, that within the Regents population, or when Regents, rather, was had this, as well as some of the other health plans, they weren't quite managing this as strictly to the line as the health plans are currently. And we do have data to support that on direction of services. Case management strategies promote appropriate consideration to comorbidities. That was assumption based into the analysis. If you would like to turn your sheet over to slide 13, this is the estimated financial savings for a year. This data was based off of the Marion Polk Health Plan's data for calendar year 2002. Our average monthly membership was 29,147. I've got half a dozen of the top service categories there, starting with emergency room, hospitalization, imaging, durable medical equipment, physical therapy, urgent care, and the rest of the services aggregated below. Now, currently there's around 152,000 members in the state of Oregon that are on open card. Given that, these gross dollar figures here are an average, or those are the estimated savings per month, which in total would be around just under $2.7 million. Now, on an annual statewide savings, we're looking at an over $32 million savings. It's important to note that this this analysis was done on the MIPCHIP members. As much as I'd like to give you a comparison between the open card membership and the health card health plan membership, I'm not able to, primarily because I don't have the open card membership data. If I had that data, then I could do a more realistic comparison, comparing apples to apples. So what I'm giving you here today is really what type of savings we can do with a population similar to the population that we have.
Representative Martin.
Just to clarify, and I accept all your givens, but your multiplier for your annual statewide savings, you were using $152K?
Yes, I was.
Okay, thanks.
I got that off the OMAP website.
All right, yeah, we've been working with a slightly lower number, but not much.
Yeah, but I think the problem with that number, I mean, it's a good enough number to use, but that's a mid-biennial number. Now, maybe it's right. I mean, you'll have fewer of those through the first half of the biennium, get to this measuring point, 151-something is what we've been looking at.
Yeah.
And then maybe it would go up from there.
Yeah.
But I don't think it would go up that much more than what it gained. So.
Well, yeah, hopefully by then the economy is good and everybody's got health insurance in our jobs. So.
Well,
I think you're awfully close here.
But
it's roughly 30% of 500,000 people. You're roughly the ballpark.
I mean, but the key is, I mean, the big caveat that Chad is talking about is they know they got good, solid, hardcore encounter data for their population. The question, and I know you can't answer it, not trying to force you, to make a wild guess, although we will stay here until we do get an answer.
Would you like red darts or green?
Yeah. How different can it be? I know there's a difference. The question is, how different can it be?
Well, I mean, we already know that roughly, two and a half to 5% are different. Extremely different.
Isn't going to qualify.
And so. What we really need to do is get OMAP to run a statistical comparison of the open card population to the other population, or give them the raw data and have them run it.
How good an encounter data does OMAP have?
Look at those stares.
Look at the smiles. Well, you're looking at, Mr. Chair, you're looking at very different populations another way, too. Some counties have managed care. Some counties don't. So the counties that don't, it'd be more of a mixture. Other counties have people coming and going off the plan. But in that mix somewhere, you have the ones you're concerned about, the high-end ones that are very expensive, renals and transplants, and maybe people have refused to cooperate with the managed care plan, and pregnancy. So that's a mix. You're not too sure what the size is.
You know, just for the record, I've got to state this. That was the most incredulous look I've ever seen three human beings give me when I asked that last question at one time.
I mean, let's pose the question a different way, sir.
All right, you're more PC than I am.
Madam X, to protect your identity.
Isn't that a book about... No.
So, yeah. Bottom line is, OMAC experience, for some understandable reasons, they're just not going to have that good of encounter data as you guys are going to have with the population that you've been managing down to a, gnat's eyelash for, the last 6-8 years. And that makes sense. But someplace in here is a coefficient that we can apply against this, 35 or whatever it is,
yes.
32 million,
right.
And come up with a pretty good number.
Need some Kentucky windage here.
Yeah, we need some Kentucky windage. Jan.
Thank you, Chair Westland.
Oh, Madam X, excuse me.
This is Madam X. I would only, and I'm certainly not the analyst that Chad is, certainly if OMAP took a year's worth of claims data, raw claims data, data that hasn't been filtered, cleaned, et cetera, if they took 1 year of raw claims data, similar to what we've done, on X number of clients, this population. And you have similar identical fields that you're comparing. You know, if they would download that to us on X number of patients, we could run the analysis. Or they could simply, you know, match the fields, use their own raw data, and they could come up with these exact numbers. But certainly we would be willing to do that for them for a finite population. It would be an interesting, if they needed assistance doing that. I know they've got staffing issues.
Well, they are listening right now. They listen to all of our meetings, and so that's probably streaming into your office as we speak. So 5 o'clock, you can...
Yeah, you have virus protection.
Yeah. Because I like this stuff. I mean, when I see an eight-digit number taken out, you know, into the hundreds on the end, the 300s, that's good stuff. Thanks.
So it's 25.
Now I know where you got those numbers we were talking about at the two restaurants we went to. But anyway, you guys are fun. This is good. Don't let me interrupt. Please continue.
I guess it's my turn here. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, let me present the Administrative Service Organization proposal.
Let me recess the committee for just a second. Okay. We'll recess the committee.
Some audio problems here. We've got to make sure we're not
all that, all that X stuff. I mean, Madam X is, you know, it's not. You were going to be Madam X from now on. I mean, that's, you know, people get branded and labeled.
One of the better titles I've had.
Yeah.
And Dr. Y.
If we read that's the official blog,
right?
It's a real bad buzz in it.
Human service budget reforms for consistency, and everyone knows today remains March 26th, and we have before us the folks from MDVIP. The please continue.
Mr. Westland, before we begin, or before Mike does, I just wanted to throw out the point that we were talking about earlier about enrollment and disenrollment and assigning the members and eligibility and so forth. That is not done by OMAP. That is done by ASF or AFS.
AFS.
Yeah.
Jeff was saying the same thing. Yeah, no, we understand that.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think before I present the ASO proposal that we have, or at least the general structure of it, I'd also like to go back to this data that Chad has just presented, and to kind of clarify some of the discussion that's already got place. I would argue that what we're looking at here is the effect of management on this population, because when we're thinking about how different is this population that we're going to have, I would argue that there's going to be a similar effect of management when it's applied to that population. We're assuming that the population is largely unmanaged at this time, and in fact the fact that they're unmanaged may imply that there is true, some of them may be sicker, but there also may be greater opportunities for savings because of the unmanaged state of the population as it is now. So I think that as we have to say that these populations are different, but it may not be different in a way which is bad. It may be different in the sense that there's more opportunity here for savings than we're even projecting.
Fair point.
So this could be the bottom of the savings rather than the top.
At any event, it's our contention that management is better than non-management in terms of saving money. And to that extent, we would like to propose that that an administrative service organization option be available such that the fully capitated health plans could enter into the same type of management of the open card patients as they do for the fully capitated patient population. And the premise of this is stated in slide 15, that is the current success in terms of controlling costs as evidenced by the summary numbers we've just presented, while maintaining access to care, which is clearly superior to what has been available before, that this can be extended to the fee-for-service population through a cooperative project between the contractors and Department of Human Services. We believe that all functions to carry out this management already exist in the fully capitated health plans. Now, there's been some acronyms that are passed around, ASO, or Administrative Service Organization, and I've listed the definitions as we see it on slide 16, and I can go over those if anyone has questions of that. We believe that the services that could be delegated for a better management would include utilization management, particularly pharmacy and DME. We believe chemical dependency, drug and alcohol, and mental health are also good candidates, and that authorization management for hospital and physician services would be good candidates for delegation. Case management.
Mike, let me interrupt you there. When you're talking about chemical dependency, DA, and mental health, are you talking about those services already being provided within the OMAP structure or in other delivery systems of drug and alcohol, mental health?
I believe that what we're speaking of is those who that are not currently under a management program. There are some management programs under the, such as, maybe Jan, do you want to answer this one?
Okay. I probably didn't ask it very well, but.
We are responsible as a health plan for a certain portion of the chemical dependency, drug and alcohol, and mental health.
And that
the services that the mental health organizations are currently not providing.
So that's what I'm. This is
the
stuff that is
side.
Inside the OMAP umbrella.
Yes, sir.
It's
yes.
Got nothing to do with what the MHOs do or any of the county delivery systems, any of that. That's just what, in some form or another, you would be providing to your managed care patients. You would then be providing to the fee for service guys.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
The and also, if there's an effective management system already in place, it would not be necessary to delegate that to a fully capitated plan.
Right, right.
We think that disease management is also something that can be delegated. Once again, local systems and local communities, we think, are superior at performing those functions. Claims administration, payment and adjudication of claims, member services and coordination of benefits. And particularly in our own shop, we find that there's a significant amount of revenue to be gained from third-party liability, where we have not only we have the strong incentives to make sure that auto insurance companies and things like that, those payments and those liabilities be transferred to those resources as opposed to the Oregon Health Plan. So those are all things that we can do.
Mr. Bukovian.
Thank you. When you're looking at the coordination of benefits, or I guess COB,
yes.
Are you able to also pull the data, mine the data in terms of telling us how much basically you do retrieve from that portion of clients, I guess if we're looking at comparing it to like a statewide level or number of people and what they're actually able to recoup?
Mr. Bukovian, actually, we've quantified those into around $2 to $3 per member per month that we're getting back.
On third-party payer?
Yeah.
Have you guys looked at that black box concept that's going around, you know, makes us, you know, one of the advantages you get out of HIPAA with the centralized databases where the physicians would bill into that black box, does the big data search, and then, oh, hey, we've got VA or Regents or Blue Cross or Aetna, and if they find, you know, a third-party payer, bill goes right there. If not, goes to OMAP. Have you guys looked into that, and do you have an opinion on those?
Mr. Chairman, I must confess that I have not seen that, so I can't really comment on it. It sounds just like a clearinghouse.
Yeah.
I really have no knowledge of that. So, sounds like a good idea, though.
Okay.
We believe that there's significant benefit by managing care at the local level, and I think that as a medical director in the past, the fact that a doctor in my community can call me up and complain when something isn't right or special deals I can make in order to make sure the patient gets the care they need. Also, my ability as a local medical director to twist arms sometimes is quite useful. And I think that whenever we have local communities and the contractors, that we have a lot closer contact and a lot better results. I think those are shown, at least in the MIPCHIP experience. We believe that continuity of care can be better maintained. These people go on and off of the plans, and by putting them into a common management structure, we can create more continuity of care such that there is less morbidity occurring with these patients, and we believe ultimately less cost. Local management, we believe, helps to hold doctors into the care of these patients, so therefore we as contractors can maintain better access. And I think most important right now, perhaps, in these days, is budget predictability. To be able to have some predictability in terms of where the budgets are going by applying some management structures as opposed to wide open, unmanaged care, I think will be critically important for us, particularly in the next biennium, if we're going to not be back here with more problems in 1 or 2 years.
Excuse me, Mike. Representative Merkley.
I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to get the broad concept framework that perhaps I'm missing. We're talking about taking all of the open card individuals and putting them into this ASO structure. And we can do that within the federal rules for open card individuals, or do we need a waiver for that? And so functionally, I'm asking multiple questions, I know, here, but then functionally, if I'm an open card member, I'm really kind of a member of an organization, if you will. There's a place that's managing my health care rather than my just showing up whenever I want to schedule an appointment, so on and so forth.
Representative Merkley, or Mr. Chairman, Representative Merkley. The general structure would be that, if I understand the question of how would an ASO work, what would it be? I think it would be analogous to a health insurance company that delegates certain functions out to a third-party administrator. And in this case, and they would retain some of the risk or all of the risk. The risk relationship would depend on a contract. So in this particular case, OMAP or DHS would contract, for example, the Mary Polk Community Health Plan. They would contract with Mary Polk Community Health Plan to manage the patients who are in the fee-for-service system. There would be some form of risk relationship such that incentives would be present. The ASO, in this case, Mary Polk Community Health Plan, would have to assume certain responsibilities in terms of access and care management. When the patient wanted a particular procedure that was either below the line or was on a pre-authorization list requiring pre-authorization, they would then, their physician, the physician who's ordering that, would interact with the managing, the clinical management entity, which in this case would be ASL or Mary Polk Community Health Plan in the specific example, and then they would carry out these management functions in the name of OMAP. So there would be a delegation of responsibility. Whether or not, I'm not a lawyer, I'm not sure all the parameters that go around in terms of whether or not this is would affect the waiver. But from my common sense kind of perspective, it seems to me that we have not taken away the responsibility or the oversight of OMAP. What we've done is we've created a situation where they delegate these management functions, which, quite frankly, in the current configuration, OMAP doesn't have the capacity to do. It's not that they couldn't do it. It's just that they don't right now have the capacity to do that. And from at least an observer from the outside, it appears that the majority of these patients are currently not effectively being managed. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, they would simply be delegating out to an organization that was more capable of performing those functions.
Mm-hmm. Well, just from a practical point of view, does this mean that an open card patient might then have a primary care provider?
Well, we would hope that open card patients would have a primary care provider. I think that certainly every plan would work to try and achieve that, I'm sure.
Thank you.
And I don't know if I misheard the first part of your question, in that I thought you were asking, Mike, that would we need a waiver, not would this affect our waiver?
Yes, whether we could do this within the existing structure.
I think, yeah, I mean.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Merkley, I don't know the answer to that question.
My common sense, I can't imagine that you'd need a waiver to bring open card into a managed care situation in the same geographic area that would hopefully, if they get their PC position, mm-hmm. would improve their access. I can't imagine that would. But again, I'm not an attorney.
Well, again, the reason I'm raising this question is not having been immersed in this as much as you all have, I've had this impression of the federal law requiring the option for an individual to have an open card, which kind of means that you're not managed in a way. And so I didn't know where the tension comes in between that. For example, if the number of physicians that you can actually go see is constrained, now in your case, virtually everybody signed up, so I don't know if there's any difference, but in other parts of the state, maybe that's different. And so that was kind of what was in the back of my head as to whether this would.
Yeah, I don't think they require. Have to have an open card. The option for an open card.
You don't have to.
Right. Here, we're going to give you the right. We're going to give you insurance, and we're going to give you the right to go out there and cost us more money.
Well, that may just be a misunderstanding on my part. I thought I'd heard that referred to.
Representative Bates.
I have a fear that Representative Murphy may be right, that there is a federal requirement for choice here, and it's one of those things that doesn't make much sense. In the back of my mind, I'm thinking that our waiver allows us to bypass that. So I have to go back and look at the waiver. I just don't remember for sure. And whether the federal government, if we need a waiver, whether the federal government would give us one, I think it's pretty high a yes vote. I mean, we're talking about giving them access to care versus hitting the ER.
Yeah.
And that is a big plus that I think the feds would probably go along with, but you never know. I have to go back and research it. I don't know for sure.
Okay.
Lifescan, folded.
I just don't know.
Spindled and mutilated.
I just don't know.
In the, and just for the record, Jeff Hetherington was nodding his head up and down that, yeah, that we have that in our waiver now. So okay. We don't need members. A new one.
Okay, my memory is correct. Okay. My memory is vaguely correct.
I mean, we're going to have to go amend it anyway, probably by the time this is all said and done. So,
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, the questions have been raised, I think, in the past as to how hard would something like this be to implement? How hard is it to delegate these things out in the current environment? And so I'd like to kind of address some of that. I think that the implementation steps in order to achieve delegation would be, first of all, the development of contracts, what those contracts would mean with the delegate, how the risk would be shared, a variety of issues that are legal in nature that would affect an ASO contract that is different than a managed care contract. So, however, those contracts exist in the marketplace right now, and I would guess that all the contractors, I don't know of any that wouldn't understand those types of relationships and be fluent with them. The other issues that have been raised is what is the technical, in terms of information systems, problems that would be presented with delegating this type of responsibility. And I would argue that these are not substantial. And the reason I would say that is that we already get eligibility data that we would need in order for an ASO to operate. It needs eligibility information. That eligibility information is already being transferred to the fully capitated health plans in an acceptable manner. The only difference, the only addition would be we'd be adding a group of patients to that. So that's simply a different selection criteria coming out of the MMIS computer system at OMAP. The other information is that if the delegation of claims processing is also delegated for this population, we are already exchanging encounter data and claims data back to OMAP into the MMIS system. We already have standards and policies for what that encounter data must contain. There already exists audits in terms to the fully capitated health plans for how this is to be carried out. And so essentially, on that level, all of that infrastructure exists. It would simply have to be applied to a new contract. On the other issue is if the claims processing were retained by OMAP, and this probably is not ideal or the easiest solution, once again, it is also quite possible to match internal record structures within the MMIS system. At MIPCHIP and PHTEC, we do this on a routine basis. Our current contract with Regis Blue Cross, we have real-time exchange of data into their claim system within seconds of a person requesting an authorization. So these are not difficult problems to solve. They've already been solved. And in many cases, the solution with OMAP is existing, functioning, and has been functioning for several years. So I think that the technical issues are small. So in summary, I would argue that fully capitated health plans are already delivering the services needed in order to provide an ASO option for these populations, that fully capitated health plans have the administrative capacity to carry this out, that the implementation would be timely. We're not looking at any insurmountable problems that we can see, that we could provide much better budget predictability than we could by not managing. By better management, we get better budget predictability. And probably just as important, when we have people going back and forth between fee-for-service and the managed care arms, we can provide more consistency in terms of delivery of service. And that management arm actually improves the care of some patients. I, you know, sometimes we think that managed care is a negative thing, but In my experience, when I was the medical director, I've removed a physician from practice who shouldn't have been there, and we could only do that through managed care contracts. I have probably gotten people into surgery as much as I've prevented surgeries, mainly because we can review these contracts and we can make sure that the appropriate care is being delivered. And when it's all done locally, we just do a lot better job. And so I would argue that this is not only a way to save money, this is a way to improve the care and a way to make the system much more accountable than it is right now.
Thank you very much. Is that a question?
Mr. I have three questions, and they're, I'm going to ask you to answer them real quickly because everyone wants to go home, but and you don't even have to answer a couple of them. You may say, I don't want to answer that. First off, are you using your ASO system on commercial plans? You guys contract a bunch of commercial plans.
Representative Bates, Mr. Chairman, we currently have been using, since 1998, the same technology in the case of Marion Cove Community Health Plan. For the Regents contract, we use it for Pacifica contracts. We use it for Marion Cove Community Health Plan. We use it in other areas of the state as well. So the answer is yes.
Yes.
Other contractors don't have the same system, but they perform the same functions, and we believe they perform the same functions probably just as well.
Eligibility enrollment in the HELP OHP is done by different groups. AFS and dual eligibles, I think, are done by probably senior services.
Yes, sir.
Could you take over that role and do that for both parties and you control eligibility enrollment yourselves?
Yes.
OMAP does a lot of work out there, but they're not at risk. And when you're not at risk, it changes your naturally changes your behavior and thought patterns. What part of what OMAP does right now, since you work with them intimately and know them, could your organization take over, and could you do it at a better cost than they can do that? That's opinion on your part. Like I said, you don't have to answer all the questions.
No, I believe that speaking strictly for Marion Cove Community Health Plan and the PH Tech, the combination that we have, I'm not sure that there's anything that we couldn't manage. I believe enrollment would be difficult because enrollment isn't actually an OMAP function right now, but we believe we could probably manage all the components of that. Saying that, the politics and the difficulty in carrying out some of those things wouldn't necessarily be easy.
Would it be less expensive for the state?
I believe that small groups like Marion Cove Community Health Plan and the other contractors are much more cost-effective for a variety of reasons. We have lightweight technologies. We don't buy big mainframes. We're fast. We're adaptable. We're right there when that doctor needs something or we have a problem, we see it right away. There's not, we do not have a large bureaucracy. So the answer to that, I believe, is yes as well. I think it would save money.
But I think Representative Bates' question was specifically directed to enrollment. Am I wrong?
Not just enrollment, Mr. Chair. Enrollment for certain, but also the other duties that OMAP carries out. An RFP on something of this nature would include enrollment, eligibility, and how you handle claims, the whole ball of wax that they do, it probably would not include any interface with CMS. That would still be an OMAP responsibility. And there would be some oversight left from OMAP, too.
Right.
But a great deal of what they do, you might be able to take on and do it in a more cost-effective and more efficient manner. And that's what I'm asking you about.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bates, I don't believe that we could take on everything that OMAP does. OMAP clearly has to do a lot of things. I think we could take on a lot of those functions, and I think we could do those things more cost-effectively. That's the idea of delegation to smaller units. They have a mission, to care for the state and to take care of, provide actuarial services, which we probably couldn't do. They have a whole financial management system, which is accountable to you all here. I mean, we obviously couldn't do that, although I do believe we provide very good data that would certainly help them in their mission as we go.
Representative March.
Just one quick one, and this is totally off the subject. You, as you're managing for your 500 physicians, do the contract for malpractice insurance. How's it been going with, like, OBGYN rates?
Mr. Chair, Representative March, malpractice premiums have increased at least four times. Increases have been sent out for one of the local statewide companies. They've also asked the members to refinance their reserves. It has been very expensive. Certainly that impacts the level to which the physicians are satisfied with their reimbursement. In terms of the OBGYN specifically, we have had a number of family practitioners who were delivering babies. They have ceased to do so. We also have had a number of OBGYNs quit delivering babies. And I was recently told that should there be any number of significant cases, and that could be as few as one, over the next few months, that would materially increase the current practitioners' malpractice costs, that they also will quit delivering babies. Fortunately, at this time, we are not having an access issue as it pertains to OBGYN, but we're at a critical juncture, certainly. I know Salem Hospital is actively recruiting an OBGYN hospitalist to take some of the pressure off the OBGYNs in the community. We also are having a number of the OHP clients that could be delivering in Salem at Salem Hospital being taken by van out to Silverton Hospital. And I'm sure Silverton Hospital provides very good care, but it actually is quite a bit more expensive for us because they're fall under the rural AB category.
Right.
So we pay significantly more out there than we do here, and it's financially concerning to us that they're being taken out there to deliver.
Thank you, Madam X, Dr. Y, and Mr. Z.
Thank you, sir.
Question. You've obviously all read our report that we produced as committee. You know we're recommending the state entering into a bulk purchasing agreement. My question is how does that impact your relationship with your PBM, and what else do they do for you, if anything, that might not get to the economies of scale where they could continue to provide that benefit for you if we were doing bulk purchasing of drugs?
Mr. Chair, I'll address this initially, and then Chad can certainly add some comments. What I'd like to state just for the record is that all of the contractors going to get together this coming Monday and go through your document, your report, to the Ways and Means Committee, and we're going to attempt to thoughtfully give you written response to all of these recommendations in a very timely fashion, hopefully by next week sometime. So hopefully we can speak as a broader group at that time. To answer your question today, we use a PBM, and they certainly provide the prescription drugs for us. They provide the panel of pharmacies within our service area. They do all the contracting with those pharmacies such that I didn't have to hire staff to go out and do that. They have the expertise. We do not. The key piece is, though, we as a company develop the formulary. We as a company manage the formulary. We as a company are managing the requests, you know, as they pertain to the formulary or not the exceptions, and we grant those or not. The PBM does not do those things for us. We would not be interested in losing our ability to develop our formulary that coincides with the prescribing practices within our service area. I think it's difficult to kind of, do a blanket formulary statewide, I don't know that we would feel that it would be as appropriate for our specific service area and prescribing patterns. The physicians in Marion and Polk County at this point in time already prescribe over 70% generics. Our PBM told us this group of practitioners has the highest generic prescribing rate in the country that they deal with, and it's a national PBM. In addition to that, since we developed our own formulary, we have shaved over $100,000 a month off our pharmaceutical costs. Our pharmaceutical costs right now are running approximately $27 PMPM. As opposed to, I heard, I do not have this written from the state, but I heard that the states run approximately about $55 PMPM. I would again have to have that information from the state. But we use the pharmaceutical monies that we save, we use to offset physician services and hospital services where we feel, it's not a criticism of the committee, that we're not funded to the point that it covers expenses. So we use that positive variance to fund
profit centered offset.
Absolutely. Yeah. In addition to our administrative costs, one of the comments in your report on page 6, and again, I'm not probably the one who should be talking to this, Dr. Rohr, perhaps our medical director, Chris Kirk. But Dr. Kirk, our medical director, wanted me to make the point that when we negotiated with our PBM, we paid them AWP minus 13%. In addition to that discount, we also get rebates. Right. So his concern was that there was some notion out there that the state got rebates, but we didn't, the plans don't, or that the state got discounts that we didn't. And it's our opinion that, you know, we have as good a deal as the state does, in addition to having the ability to manage these clients.
Right, and the reason I brought that up is it Monday meeting you're all getting together? Is that's a key point we'd like you to try to work on and address.
Yes, sir.
When Bill Murray, when we were talking about it, we formulated this nice little, tentative coalition and in the work group, that was an issue of concern that we're aware of. You're obviously aware of the state's position, and someplace through all of this, we have to make it go like this and create, long term, the absolute best service delivery model we possibly can. And that's what I think opportunity is right in front of us, and we can't let that pass.
That certainly would be our goal, sir.
And so that's why I brought that issue up. That I think that could be one of the most nettlesome problems in here. Because, hey, end of the day, it's got to work for you. It's got to work for the state. Someplace we've got to find the will and the creativity to make that happen.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair. Representative Bates.
On the same line, since you're going to this meeting Monday, I might try to make the intent, I think, of the work group and the committee clear on this issue. We're hoping that through bulk purchasing and supplemental discounts, we can get a better price for those drugs than the individual plans can. But we absolutely know the plans have to manage their pharmaceuticals, not on a statewide basis, but on a community basis. We're not interested in a statewide basis. We're not interested in formulary statewide. We're not interested in prior authorization statewide. That must stay within the plans. And we want as many people, as I've said before, who are on fee-for-service in those plans or managed by the plans. And there would have to be a change in the capitation rates to make up for that loss. But we want to get the best of both worlds. Your management systems, bulk purchasing, supplemental discounts, if they're better than what you're getting now, to lower the overall cost of the state without hurting you. We're not trying to damage, we're not trying to make money from you on this differential. We want to get a better price for drugs, have you manage them to the best for the state. And we hope there'll be gains also in that fee-for-service population as you bring them into your plans.
Yeah, thanks for emphasizing that point, because top-down, rigid formulary doesn't work for you guys.
No, sir.
We see you as the backbone of the delivery system.
I mean, there's arguments for and against anything we want to talk about here.
Sure.
I think the one thing there's a great deal of unanimity here is that you guys are the backbone of the delivery system, so it's got to work.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bates, I will tell you it's been a very learningful experience to negotiate with PBMs. It's a very difficult negotiation. They're very difficult numbers to nail down. The numbers move around all the time. You can feel like you're getting a great discount when in reality you're paying more. We certainly, as a group of contractors, have talked about the degree to which we could come together and negotiate with the PBMs as a larger body. So certainly we'd entertain any opportunity to reduce costs.
We might have some help coming for you. Film at 11.
That's my little pet project. We'll talk to you about.
Any other questions? Any other business coming before the committee? Seeing none, we are adjourned.